The following message is from Pastor Steve Lee of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found at emmanuelcommunity.org.
I just want to ask you to think as I start my message this morning about how it makes you feel when somebody says, there's something I want you to do for me. I think the truth is most of us kind of tighten up a little bit, don't we? Kind of bracing ourselves for very likely something we don't want to hear, whatever's going to come next. Now think about somebody who knows you pretty well, pulling you aside and quietly asking you, can I share a word with you? Can I share a word with you? It's not a demand, but it's an offer to share something that this person wants for you. And it may still actually, if we're honest, make us a little bit nervous, right? If someone says that to us. But if it's coming from somebody that we love and trust, I think the truth is you'd be curious to hear what they have to say. This morning, we're starting into a new series. And though it's traditionally been called the Ten Commandments in the church, we're actually entitling it 10 words. 10 words. Because that's actually how the Bible refers to it. It doesn't actually call it the Ten Commandments. The Bible itself addresses it as the 10 words. Of course, those words do contain commands. But calling them words reminds us that they are more than just a list of rules to obey. They are words meant to form us in wisdom, teaching us what life with God actually ought to look like. When we hear them as nothing more than commands, our instinct is simply to ask, what is it I have to do? But when we receive them as words from a loving Father, we begin asking deeper questions like, what kind of person is God shaping me into? What kind of life leads to the flourishing that God desires for me? Think of it like this. Think of it like wedding vows. The words that a bride and groom exchange at the wedding altar are binding, aren't they? And they require something of each of them. But the interesting thing is, we don't call them wedding commands, do we? We call them vows, because they're spoken in the context of a covenant that two people are making with each other as they give themselves to one another. And I think this is the way we need to think about the Ten Commandments. They are 10 words from God. They are not a set of rules or an ethical code alone, but they are an invitation into a relationship from a God who loves his people. And to really hear God's heart behind these 10 words, we have to go all the way to the very beginning. Before there were these 10 words at Mount Sinai, there was the first word that God spoke to Adam and Eve in the garden. After creating the world, the very first thing that God says to human beings is actually a blessing. Genesis 1:28, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. So the first time God ever tells human beings what to do, it isn't interestingly framed as a command, but a blessing, an invitation to share in God's own creative, life-giving work that he does. And then a second word to man and woman come in Genesis 2, and this one explicitly is called a command in chapter 2, verse 16 to 17. And the Lord God commanded the man, you are free to eat from the tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat from it, you will certainly die. God begins, in other words, by inviting them to enjoy all the good things that he has made. That's interestingly the first real command there. But then he warns them that there are also dangers in paradise. Specifically, he says, do not eat from this one tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because if you do, you will surely die. Every tree in the garden was beautiful. and desirable. And yet what God says is one of them will bring you death. And the problem was that there was no visible sign to distinguish that one tree from all the good trees. In fact, they could not rely on their desire to guide them either, because all of them were desirable in their eyes, even the forbidden one. So then the question is, how could you possibly tell the difference between what merely looks good and what is truly good for you? And what we find in the creation story is that God says, the only way that you are going to know this is from my word. My word. That's the only way. And this is the first lesson that Adam and Eve had to learn, is how to know good from evil. Not by trusting your own eyes or even the desires that pull you, but simply by listening to the voice of God. And the tragedy of this story is that they trusted their own perceptions about what was good over and against God's own word, and so they ate that forbidden fruit, and with that came death. And I think the instinct is to choose our own wisdom over God's own word. And that is the human condition. We want what is good, but left to ourselves, we cannot reliably tell the good from its counterfeit. And so we keep reaching for what looks like life, but turns out to be death. That's the human condition. We want what is good for our lives, but so often we end up choosing the wrong thing, and it leads only to death. We still believe deep down that we can work out the good on our own, even in our generation, so many years later, don't we? I want you to think about this interesting phenomenon that only arose in the last couple of years of what are called the prediction markets, platforms like Polymarket and Kalshi. Are you familiar with them? Some of you on them, where people put real money on just about anything. Who will win an election? Which sports team is going to win the game? Whether or not a celebrity is going to say a particular word at an event. It's crazy what you could bet on. And what was interesting to me is that rather than thinking of these as betting platforms, the founders of these companies really had very high and lofty goals, because they hoped that their apps would actually help humanity by more accurately predicting the future based on what is known as the wisdom of the crowd. And the thinking goes like this: no single person knows the future, but if you let thousands of people put their money where their mouth is, then the totality of all that betting will predict the future way better than any expert could. And that's a beautiful theory. But that's just not how the way the story has unfolded with these prediction markets. In recent months, these platforms have been rocked by one scandal after another, with accusations of insider trading and people even manipulating the very outcomes that they were betting on. And they were realizing more and more that this whole system seems to be gamed. And we want to believe the best about human nature, don't we? And instead, we just keep watching the worst of what we are showing up and ruining everything. Let me point to one more thing here in my introduction to this series, and then I promise you we'll get to the actual teaching about the first command, the first word. I think many of us were taught that God's law had essentially one purpose, and that was to show us that we can't keep it. In other words, these rules that God made only exist to expose our failure, to, in essence, crush us under the weight of the demands that they make on us, so that we realize our need for grace. Now, I want to say this. The law does expose our sin, but if that's the only purpose that they serve, then God's commands become nothing more than traps intended to make us fail. This perspective on the law points to a deeper problem, I think, of seeing salvation only in terms of what we are saved from. In other words, salvation is all about avoiding judgment, condemnation, punishment, and death. And thank God he does save us from those things. But he is just as concerned about what we are saved for, which is a life of flourishing, fruitfulness, communion with God and with one another. In other words, we can view God's commands as negative restrictions that drain the joy out of life, rules, in other words, intended to just trip us up and make us feel ashamed of ourselves. But even in Paradise of Eden, there were boundaries. Because honoring these boundaries was the very way that humanity could flourish and experience the fullness of life God intended for us. And God begins his 10 words like this in Exodus 22. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. This is not a command, but it is a declaration that he had already rescued his people and set them free. In other words, the commands come after the deliverance, not before it. God didn't come to a nation of slaves and tell them, clean up your lives and obey these commands. And I'll come back in a few years and see how you're doing and see if you deserve to be set free. He rescued them out of his love for them. And then he gave them these commands, also as an expression of his love for them. Salvation is not the reward for our obedience, but the reason for it. In other words, the Israelites' entire identity was forged through 400 years of slavery in Egypt. For generations, they were nothing more than the property of Pharaoh. They could do nothing on their own. They were told where to go, what to eat, what to do. And now, for the first time, Israel is a free nation. And they are gathered at the foot of Mount Sinai. And the hanging question over them is, how do we live? How do we live? And God was showing Israel the kind of life he desired for them as a community set apart to reflect his own character among the nations. The truth is that most of these commands are stated in the negative, and that's kind of off-putting to a lot of us. You shall not, you shall not, you shall not. But hidden inside every one of these negatives is a positive invitation into a completely different way of life. If God does not want us to kill, how should we think about all human life, even the ones that I deem to be worthless, even my enemies? If God does not want us to commit adultery, how should I think about the sanctity of marriage and real love? It's interesting that in the creation story in Genesis 1, this phrase, and God spoke, occurred, interestingly, 10 times. And through his word, he calls into existence all of the goodness that he desires for his creation, for humanity. But the rest of Genesis shows just how far humans drifted from God's design, and he continually choosing our own way rather than trusting and following God. And now, here in Mount Sinai, it is though God is offering a new beginning once again, speaking 10 words to this newly formed nation of Israel. And these words were not given as traps to trip them up, but as the expression of his love, guiding them into the kind of life that will lead to their own flourishing. And what's interesting is on the third day of creation, God made all the vegetation and in essence basically created fruitfulness, all the seeds and all the fruit-bearing trees. And basically it was a day of creating fruitfulness in his creation. And then what's interesting is that on the third day of the month, God gives these 10 words. And what we're told in Psalm 80, verse 8, is that Israel was described as a vine that was transplanted out of Egypt to be his own people. And so just as God spoke on the third day fruitfulness into his creation, it is as if on the third day of the month, God is taking the vine of Israel and speaking again 10 words to allow them to flourish in this land that he was giving them. And I think this is the framework around which we ought to understand these 10 words that we're going to explore in the months ahead. Each one is a word spoken by God who loves us and rescued us and shows us how to live a life of true abundance and fruitfulness. Well, that was my long introduction to the series. Let me just say a brief word on the first command then. Have no other gods before me. Exodus 20, verse 3 says, "You shall have no other gods before me." This is the first word that God speaks because it is foundational to all the others. Everything that follows about how we treat marriage and property and truth and parents and our neighbor will flow out of this one. If the negative command is to have no other gods before him, then the positive invitation is worship and trust God alone. Worship and trust God alone. The vocation God gave humanity in the garden is to be his image bearers, to reflect his character and his rule into the world. And in speaking these 10 words to Israel, God is acting like a father, speaking to his child, disclosing his own character so that his child can grow up in his image. God designed us in such a way that as image-bearing creatures, we become shaped by what we worship. And by worshiping God and trusting his ways, we will become more like him. But this is also true of anything else that we choose to worship besides God. Psalm 115, 4 through 8 says, "But their idols are silver and gold, made by human hands. They have mouths but cannot speak, eyes but cannot see. They have ears but cannot hear, noses but cannot smell. They have hands but cannot feel, feet but cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. Those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them." What this psalm is saying is that we become what we worship. We become what we worship. We are transformed into the very likeness of the things we worship. Whatever you give your ultimate allegiance to, your adoration to, will slowly remake you into its image. You worship something dead, and you will become spiritually deadened, is what the psalm is saying. You worship something cruel, and you yourself will become cruel. You worship money, and your entire spirit will become calculating about everything, judging everything by its monetary value. You worship sex and lust, and you will begin to judge the worth of every person based on their physical desirability. We are formed by what we worship, every time without exception. The first word, in other words, is not an expression of God's insecurity grasping for our undivided attention. It is God protecting the very thing that makes us human. He created us in his image, and we can only become like him if we worship him and him alone. The moment our worship goes to something else, we become deformed into something lesser than what he intended for us. This is what Peter Lighthart says, that the first word is nothing less than a summons to walk in resurrection life. By obeying that first command, it is in essence God's invitation to enter into life itself, to become in the image of God. And without this first word, none of the others matters at all. But get this one right, and all the others will flow out of it. Another thing that I want to say to give context to this first word is this. Israel lived surrounded by nations that practiced polytheism, the worship of many gods. All the other nations had multiple gods, one for the weather, one for the harvest, one for fertility, one for war. And it would have made no sense to these other nations that Israel's God demanded to be worshipped alone. Look more carefully at the wording of the command, the word in Exodus 20, verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me. Before me. That Hebrew word, it's alpanai, literally means before my face. Before my face. In other words, what God seems to be conveying is when you worship other gods, it is like you are flaunting your love for something else right in the face of God himself. John Calvin, the great reformer, said that sin is, quote, like a shameless woman who brings in an adulterer before her husband's very eyes, reflecting on this first word of God. Kevin DeYoung, a pastor, brings Calvin's comparison to life in this following pretty jarring way. Suppose a husband came home and said, honey, I want to introduce someone who's very special to me. Don't get me wrong, you're also very special to me, but I've met someone else. She's lovely, and I'm going to spend some time with her, but also a lot of time with you. Some nights I'll be around, sometimes I won't be around. I think you two will get along just fine. You'll be great friends. You both mean so much to me. What should a wife say in this situation? That's great, dear. I'm honored that I can still be part of your life. Hardly. The wife would say, it's me or her. Make up your mind. And if the wife were to say that with a great deal of passion, would anyone think she was being cruel or intolerant? No, we would say that she's being just the sort of wife she ought to be. She has every right to be jealous. We'd be concerned if she wasn't angry. Some relationships are meant to be either or, not both and. Marriage is a relationship that demands forsaking all others. If this illustration makes you a little uncomfortable or feels a bit extreme, the truth is it gets a bit more graphic than that. I took out those elements because I just wasn't willing to say those at the pulpit. But that's actually part of the point. I think that's part of the point of this first word that God gives, because it gives us a glimpse into how personally God takes divided worship. Love, in other words, is at the very heart of this first command. That is why the Shema is so central to Israel. Deuteronomy 6:4, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. One of the biggest problems I think that we have is this attitude of God and. God and. That little word and is exactly where God's people have always stumbled, isn't it? So you see, I think the problem is rarely that we want to walk away from God entirely. The problem is that we want to keep God and so many other lovers. We're happy enough for God to occupy a certain corner of our lives, so long as he leaves us alone to fill the rest with whatever we want to love. But God has no interest in simply being one among many important figures in our life. He cannot be rightly worshipped, in other words, if he is worshipped alongside anything else. As Jesus himself would say years later, no one can serve two masters. You are fooling yourself if you think you can get away with that. And so it is here that we have to begin our journey into these 10 words. Do you love and worship God and God alone? Does God not only have an important place, but the only place of worship in your heart? I just want to leave you with four questions that I've been just meditating on as the week has gone by and I've been preparing this message. It comes from Kevin DeYoung. And he offers what I found to be such rich thoughts of reflection. And it is this: whom do you praise? Whom do you praise? You may compliment your children or your spouse or your friends, but ask yourself, who receives the highest praise in your life? Secondly, whom do you count on? Of course, we go to doctors and we have accountants and we go to dentists and we have friends who will help us in times of need. But at the end of the day, above everyone else, who do you turn to for the greatest help? Whom do you long for? Whom do you long for? Where do you turn for purpose and joy? Is it food? Is it work? Is it the streaming services, your phone? Or do you turn to the God of the universe to find what you long for most? And lastly, it is this: whom do you thank? Where do you think your good days come from? Is there even thankfulness in your heart when you think of all the good that you received in your life? I've been, throughout this week, thinking about these four questions over and over, and I think it's actually revealed in my heart how on a day-to-day basis, how little my heart naturally turns to God in these moments of thankfulness or longing or praise. And I think what God is saying is he's not giving these things to beat us over the head with them. But I think in essence what he's saying is, you have been made to be my image bearer. But the problem is, you are going to bear the image of wherever you fix your gaze, wherever you turn your love to. And if it isn't me, it's going to be something else. And that something else is going to make you lesser always. So in essence, God is saying, fix your gaze on me. Not other people, not your circumstances, on me. And then I think the second thing that God is saying to us is, I must not just be one among the loves in your life. I must be the consuming love in your life. It cannot work any other way. It doesn't work any other way. You lose this first word, and you lose everything else. Nothing else really, in essence, matters. Let's pray.